This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Hello, and welcome to Woman's Hour. I'm Anita Rani, and this is our very special programme on Bank Holiday Monday, all about ageing, an undeniable truth of life, which will happen to us all if we're lucky. We'll get older. So to get into this huge subject, I've got a brilliant panel of guests with me in the studio to discuss all the things we think about and perhaps worry about when it comes to ageing, the highs and the lows, the positive attitudes and the creaking bones. But before I introduce them, have a listen to this.
I'm definitely the cliche of saying like, I'm miles happier than I was younger. I don't want to ever go back there. I mean, every single magazine, Instagram, anything, it's all about thou shalt not age. You know, it's a dirty word, isn't it? I think we're all obsessed by it. It's sort of pathological. You know, it's almost a crime. There's shame attached.
The older you get sometimes, particularly women, we can become invisible. But actually, we still have so much to give in knowledge and experience. And what we want to still provide to our friends, our community, there are so many things that we can do if you just forget what age someone is and just look at a person and take them for who they are.
I think women come into their 40s, certainly mid-40s, thinking, oh, well, you know, this is the beginning of the decline. Things start to change and fade and kind of slide in directions that I don't want them to go in anymore. And, you know, I've just decided, no, we become more woman, more powerful, more sexy. We grow into ourselves more. We have opportunity to speak and speak our mind and, you know, not be afraid of what people think of us, not care what we look like quite so much. I think it's amazing. And we, you know, let's go, girls. Let's just be in our power. Why not? Life's too flipping short, you know?
40 was important. 50 was important, even 60. But I think in my imagination, I never got beyond that because just in terms of averages, one can't be confident about it. And also, I didn't see enough women who were this age that I am now to have examples to follow.
You heard the voices of the glorious feminist activist Gloria Steinem, still blazing at 90. Also actor Kate Winslet, broadcaster Angela Rippon and actor Helena Bonham Carter telling us how they all feel about ageing. A smattering of stardust to kick us off. And now to my crew in the studio. Dr. Sharon Blackie, who invented the word haggitude. She's here to tell me why and what being an older woman should be all about. Pippa Stacey, a young woman whose perceptions of ageing have changed because of her experience of a chronic illness. Dr. Radha Modgill, resident expert on BBC Radio 1, will be speaking to us about how to age healthily. And Callie Beaton, she was a top TV exec who swapped the boardroom for the stage and became a comedian who now refuses to make self-deprecating jokes, but will happily take down mansplaining the menopause. That's how you actually came onto my radar. Praise be the algorithm. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. I've got a quick fire question for all of you. I'm going to start with you, Sharon. What's your age and how do you feel about it? And what age do you feel?
I am 62. I do finally feel my age. I feel 62. I think ageing is absolutely brilliant. These have been the best decade, I would say, best years of my life.
The best decade. Mm-hmm. That's nice to hear. Kelly?
Well, I'm 55 and the way I feel and the age I feel oscillates from about 14 to probably at the most 55. So it depends on the day, depends what I'm doing. I would definitely say that my 50s has been my best decade so far. But there are multiple sides to it, but overall I'm going to go best decade so far.
Interesting. We will get into that. Pippa?
I'm 29. I'm often told that I look like a 16-year-old, but I have a body that often feels like a 50-year-old. So I feel like I have the best of both worlds, and my age seems to oscillate the age I feel as well. I want to appreciate where I'm at now, and I'm holding on to the hope that better days are ahead as well.
Wonderful. And Radha?
So I'm 44, going to be 45 in August. I still think I'm 17. I sometimes act like it. I actually really have enjoyed my 40s. I think I feel much more confident. I feel a little bit more like I know who I am.
We've kicked things off. Brilliant way to start the conversation about ageing. But first, I'm going to come to you, Sharon. Dr. Sharon Blackie, author and psychologist, wrote her book, Haggitude, Reimagining the Second Half of Life, in 2022, where she explored stories of little-known but powerful elder women in European myth and folklore with the hope of inspiring women now. Sharon, welcome to the programme. Women being elders, not elderly, is a big part of your book and your thinking around ageing. So what does that mean? What does it look like?
Well, we have a culture that tells us that we are elderly by the time we get through menopause and everything begins to sag a little bit. And really, what the old stories tell us is how older women back in the day used to be elders. And so they used to have a particular form of wisdom that it was believed kind of came in post-menopause, came in with menopause and then kind of grew in the rest of their lives. And so it seemed to me that if we have a culture that hasn't got any good stories to tell about aging as women, maybe we could go back and look at some of the older stories, because our ancestors were very wise about some things, about the environment and about women. And it's not to say that, you know, there was social equality back in the day, but there was a respect for certain ways of being a woman and certain characteristics. And so those old stories have been a really great source of inspiration to me.
So what changed?
It's a very, very good question. I think men really were the ones who were driving the narrative, certainly in the past 200-300 years. And it's got to a stage where women are just not seen as being useful to the culture. Whereas back in the day, you know, the wisdom of elder women was really, really very important. So we had women, older women who were mentors to the young. We had older women who were truth tellers when the culture needed to hear some difficult truths about itself. We had older women who literally wove the world into being. We had a great group of older women in ancient Greece called the Furies, whose job it was to be furious about anything they thought they should be furious
can
about.
Hard relate.
Exactly. So that's the kind of story that we have. And I think it can give us a lot of inspiration for how we could be more useful and more authentic as we grow older.
And you also look into fairy tales. Can we find inspiration in them for women now?
I don't see why we can't. I mean, really, the beauty of these stories is that they're very simple, but the images in them and the characters in them are very, very vivid, and so they're very, very memorable. And if you look at, you know, old folklore, say from the Slavic countries, like Baba Yaga, who's an old witch-like character who rides around the woods in a mortar wielding a pestle instead of a broomstick and lives in a house with chicken legs. And if you go to her wanting, say, her fire, you either pass her tests or you'll get put into her man-sized oven and eaten up. And that sense of the older women trying to bring out the best in younger people, testing them, you know, to the absolute brink of who they could be, that's something that we don't find kind of acceptable in the culture today. But these old stories tell us very different.
So very positive. Mm. So you see, I'd have thought of Baba Yaga and thought it was a negative telling of an older woman, but
She's ambiguous. And you know what's interesting about a lot of these older characters is they're not all love and light. There is a sense of strength, of feistiness, of telling unpleasant or, you know, difficult truths when they need to be told. And I think that that's something that women can do, and they can do it kindly. You don't have to be rude to everybody. And it's something that older women, I think, have a particular gift for, because we have seen a lot as we've got to this age and we have a lot of wisdom to share.
So where did the word haggitude come from? It's a great word.
Yeah, well, I literally woke up one night in the middle of the night. I sat up in bed. I said haggitude to the bedroom at large, and then I went back to sleep again. And then the next morning I woke up and I thought, yeah, that would be a really good word for a book, title for a book. But what's interesting about the word hag in fairy tales is all of the older women who are presented as hags are in that story not because they're somebody's mother, not because they're somebody's wife or somebody's grandmother or somebody's daughter. They might be, but they're in that story for themselves, for their own particular unique gifts and everything that they have to share with the world around them. So to me, the word hag is a really strong word.
And you've looked into Native American thinking around aging. How is that different to our Western understanding?
Well, certainly I've spoken to a number of people from the Lakota tradition, and they seem to suggest that when you stop bleeding, the power stays inside you. You know, the power of the blood actually stays inside you, and the creativity stays inside you rather than being put out into the world with your children and what have you. And so that power gives you an extra strength, gives you an extra wisdom that otherwise you wouldn't have. In the South African traditions that I have heard of, there is a particular sense that older women who have never had children have a particular sense of wisdom and have a particular kind of way of being in the world that is valued. So I think all of these other cultures do it. We do it as well. If you go back to the old stories, it's just that we've forgotten.
And how do you feel? You said that you feel better now. This last decade has been the best yet for you.
Yeah, I don't mind invisibility. You know, I think it's quite a good thing. A lot of women say as they get older, they become less visible. And a lot of women find that difficult. I think a lot of my friends actually find it very, very easy to become invisible. It takes the pressure off you. You don't have to please all the time as you did when you were younger. I think that whole narrative about getting older, being able to to tell your own truth, being able to be authentic, not having to please all of the people around you, again, not to be unpleasant to people. That's a really important thing. And that can make for many of us this kind of second half of our lives really very, very, very revelatory.
I wonder what class does to this story, you know, what impact that has on how women age and their power.
It's interesting. I grew up in a profoundly poor environment in a northeastern England council estate. And when I was a kid, all of the older women on that council estate were basically the moral arbiters of the whole culture. So I had a great aunt, Aunt Meg, who would stand on her doorstep with her voluminous breasts and her apron, and she would, you know, cross her arms and stand on the street, basically telling all of the people who went past what she thought of them. And it wasn't to be wicked. It wasn't to insult them. It was because they were not conforming to the morals and the customs of that time. And so I grew up with a strong sense of old women being sometimes quite difficult, but actually powerful in a social and cultural sense.
Within their community, though.
Within their community, for sure.
But power within with wider society, not so much.
Absolutely. But it's interesting, if you have enough older women in different cultures that are doing that, then it eventually seeps out, I think, in some ways.
Oh, it's getting good already, isn't it? We've only just kicked off. Today's programme, I must tell our listeners, has been pre-recorded, so we can't include your messages, but lots of you have been in touch via social media, so I'm going to read a few out now. Joanna says, I'm probably like many of my 43-year-old peers, a little conflicted. I love the fact I'm far more secure in who I am and don't feel any need to people please or care what others think of me. I've come to a place where I'm settled in my spiritual beliefs, all wonderful. They're not so wonderful, fatigue, mood swings, unexplained weight gain, night sweats, and not recognising my own face in the car window reflection. Mercedes says, I've noticed I'm ageing recently, not because I feel old, but because people stop acknowledging you. That's what you were talking about there, invisibility. Eyes slide off you in the shop. Conversations ignore your contribution. Employers want younger women rather than experienced, then complain about their family commitments with children. In contrast, being past 50, I am less tolerant of bad office behaviour. I don't want locker room language said to me at work or to female colleagues. And Jade says, at the age of 21, I thought I was invincible until I fell from my bike on holiday, fracturing my skull and leaving me hospitalised in critical condition. Now, as I approach my 30th, it feels like such an achievement. Every birthday feels that way. But to make it to 30, wow, I'm overwhelmed with joy. What a gift it is to be alive and to age. I'm going to be reading more of your messages out throughout the programme. But on to our next guest, NHS Dr. Ratha Modgill. Ratha, you might have heard her on Life Hacks on Radio 1. One of the things we want to talk to you about is how we all age better as women. I want to focus on physical and mental well-being here, not necessarily looks. We will get there, but not top priority just yet. How much of ageing is in our head and how much is in our body, Ratha?
I suppose, obviously, there's an undeniable truth that as we age, our bodies age too, and there are limitations. There are, sometimes we see those as restrictions, but actually, it's interesting about how we approach aging, because I think as a society and also in the health system, we tend to just approach aging or kind of older people's health conditions when they reach a crisis level, so when they become a problem or when they become a diagnosis. But what I'm much more keen on talking about is how we actually talk about healthy aging. So how can we talk about promoting getting older and not necessarily seeing those physical kind of changes in our body as restrictions or limitations, but rather just that our bodies are different. You know, the population is aging. We're having, you know, more people living longer, which is great in one way, but it's only great if we're actually supporting people to live in a healthy way. I think what you said about mental health particularly, we never really talk about as we age. We tend to focus on physical kind of health, but mental health we don't really talk about very much at all.
Until today.
Until today.
We're going to cover it all. Let's start with exercising, because I know people will be really leaning in right now going, come on, tell us, what can we do? What can women do?
So as we get older, one of the main things we have to think about is our bone health and our muscle strength, basically, and that muscle strength as well. So one of the most important things is to think about weight training or strength training. So about twice a week, for example. Again, that can be external weights. It can be body weight. But I think sometimes as we get older, we think, oh, we can't do that. You know, we can't go into a gym, we can't lift heavy weights. But actually, it's really important.
Can you lift tins of beans at home?
Yes, well, that,
does
absolutely.
That work? You know, if you don't want to go to gym.
Biscuits. Well, you might need quite a few packets of biscuits to equal the beans weight. But Absolutely. I think, again, gardening, digging, lifting cans of beans in your kitchen, hoovering, all those kind of things all kind of add to that. But then we also need to think about things like flexibility. So things like yoga. Yoga is really great for our connective tissue, our joints, for example, and also for our minds as well. And then you want to balance that with things like Tai Chi. So we know as we get older, our balance deteriorates. So things like Tai Chi has been shown to improve balance by about 40% in some cases. So there are just a couple of things about mixing it up, I think. I think variety and mixing up, making it enjoyable, is one of the most important things as we get older.
What about people with restrictions in their movement or their energy levels or their health generally?
Yeah, so it's about working out what works for you, really. And I think this is where, again, society's attitude to ageing and sort of health tends to kind of take a stamp and sort of template people. You know, we must all do these things. But actually, ageing is not uniform. We all age differently according to genetics, our circumstances, what's happened in our lives, for example. So, how can we make exercise bespoke and how can we make things individual?
Well, I mentioned beans. Kelly mentioned biscuits. read into that what you want. What about nutrition?
Yeah. So again, talking about bone health, really important to think about calcium, vitamin D, for example, for that, and to prevent osteoporosis. Also things like vitamin B12, which we tend to absorb less of as we get older. So making sure we're getting a lot of that, more of that in our diets, is really important. But it's not just kind of what we eat, it's also how we eat, I think. So we know that as you get older, appetite and thirst change. So we tend to kind of lose appetite. We tend to not notice when we need something to drink. And that's for different changes in the brain. For example, there's an area in the brain called the lamina terminus, which is to do with our thirst sensation, which is affected as we get older. And we think that appetite changes because our sense of smell is also affected in taste. So, all of that part of how we eat, that social side of it, eating with other people, is all part of appetite.
And we talked about class, but what about women of different ethnicities? I think it's really important to discuss how people from different backgrounds can age in different ways too.
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting to think about, in different cultures, how do they approach ageing? We touched on it a little bit earlier on, didn't we, about different cultures, about societal kind of narratives, about kind of how older women are seen within family structures, within community structures. So we know in some cultures, my dad is of Indian descent, and, older women are very much revered and respected in that culture. So I've grown up with that. So it's just interesting to think about your own experiences and how that actually has reflected on your behaviours. And if you haven't had a great experience with that, then actually, can you step out of that? How can you change that for yourself? I think it's really important to say that, those things and how you move forward in your life doesn't have to be dictated by what you've seen and by your past.
We're on Woman's Hour, and we talk a lot about HRT, contraception, pelvic floor all the time, and it still feels like there's a lot of guesswork in treating women's health issues at different ages and stages, and all of that impacts on our quality of life, doesn't it? In fact, on our social media, a lot of women got in touch to say, well, it's all well and good to say I feel really positive about my aging experience when you're in your 40s, but get to your 70s when everything's creaking and you might not be able to get access to the things that you need as easily as you want.
The last few years we've had, much more conversation about the menopause, which has been great. But I still think, if you think about the medical kind of world, that's been orchestrated by men for decades, that's been designed by men, and all, lots of products, for example, lots of medicines, lots of health research has been very male dominated. So, we are very behind with that. And I think it's really important that we start to talk about issues more, we start to empower women with knowledge and actually kind of what they can do. But more to the point, I think we also need to give people the opportunity to have choices, to be able to make choices for themselves, to actually look at people as an individual.
We've had a message from our listener, Catherine. She says, I don't mind ageing at all, but perimenopause has completely ruined the journey into my second spring. I'm up to my eyes in HRT, but still struggling after 4 years. I'll be so happy when this is over, as it's robbed me of my late 40s and God knows for how much longer. I do feel lucky to be here and love my friends and family, but feel like I'm just existing rather than living at the moment.
Really hard. And again, it's such a shame, isn't it, that the experience of that natural transition, that natural period that we're all going to face is caused so much distress. And I suppose one of the main things is to talk about actually, if one form of HRT doesn't work, if things are not right for you, then going back to chat to your doctor, going to get some support and some help. We're very behind with that, and we're not good as a society to talk about that, but we absolutely need to get better, because again, this impacts not just you know, that individual, but their friends, their family, all the people around them, and also society in terms of ability to work and to function and basically to create the sort of society that we want.
Exactly. And this is a big question, which I'm going to bring all of you in on, actually. And it's about identity and how our identity can change as we move through the world and we get older and we move to different places and meet different people. And a lot of that might be wrapped up in a kind of purpose. It doesn't have to be a job. How important is that as we get older?
Yeah, so again, we don't talk enough about purpose, about our why. Why do we get out of bed? Why are we here? What are we here to do? And actually, research has shown that, you know, if you have a clear sense of purpose, you're going to live longer, but you're also going to have a healthier and a happier life. It's so important. And purpose, you know, throughout our lives, every single day, our purpose is going to change, but we don't always catch up with ourselves. Often, if we've been, you know, in a working role or been in a caregiving role, for example, and that then ends, you find people getting very lost and disorientated. Who am I now? You know, I'm not someone who goes to the office every day. I'm not someone who's got teenage children at home, for example. Sure. You know, who am I? And that can make, you know, your mental health very, very challenging, very difficult. So, yeah, purpose is everything. So sitting back and saying, right, who am I now? You know, what situation am I in right now? And what do I want to do? What do I want to bring to the world? And actually translating that into activities, hobbies, you know, keeping busy, keeping motivated. It's really, I think, purpose and identity of who you are in the world, and we touched on it a little bit with invisibility, is everything as we get older.
You were nodding, Sharon.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of those psychologists who's influenced a lot of my work is Carl Jung, who was a, you know, an elderly man by the time he died, but he wrote a lot about the difference between the first half of life and the second half of life. And for him, the first half of life was very much about building, about an external perspective on the world, about, you know, building a home, building a family, building a career, whatever it might be. It's about your persona. It's finding your place in the world. But he said that the second half of life, too, both for men and for women, but I think women have it in a much bigger way with the menopause and all the hormones going awry. The second half of life is time for turning inwards and thinking about meaning. And he saw the second half of life as a spiritual transition. Well, we're a culture that doesn't talk very comfortably about spirituality, meaning and purpose. And I think it really is time to change, because the other elephant in the room when we're talking about purpose and about the second half of our lives is that it ends by design with death. And we're also a culture that doesn't talk about death. And if we can't talk about death, we can never talk about healthy aging. We're always wanting to cling on to youth at all costs. Mm. And I think that is something that it would be really interesting to open up more conversations around.
Yeah, Kelly, you found your purpose.
Well, I think it's a combination of pleasure and purpose. That's what I think. I think if about 80% of what you do ticks the box of pleasure or purpose, and sometimes, if you're really lucky, both, I think we can all tolerate the 20%. And it's definitely one thing I have really noticed as you get older is money. You know, I'm the sole breadwinner. I need to earn money. But money can't be the motivator. And I think a lot of your strategies reach their sell-by dates. So things that we would have done that are maybe about external validation, about making a quick bit of money, about really letting things people say to you kind of blow your skirt up. I think those kind of shift. And actually it is about, yeah, I've only really discovered who I think I am since I was 45.
And Pippa, you really... It was thrust on you. You had no choice to figure out your identity from a young age.
Absolutely, yeah. When I acquired my disability, I went from feeling like a typical active young person to feeling like a patient. And it was very difficult to reconnect with who I was outside of my chronic illness and recalibrate that balance of my chronic illness does influence my identity, but it isn't everything. And I think as well, having a condition like mine that kind of affects your ability to reach those traditional milestones of aging, I think that reconnecting with that purpose and thinking, right, what do I want to do? What can I do with what I have? That has been one of the things that has helped me get through that and not feel so isolated by that.
We're now going to hear from three fantastic women. Woman's Hour went along to meet Lindy, Sue and Celia at the British Library in London, where they were attending a meeting for the Older People's Advisory Group, a forum for older community members organised by Age UK Camden. We asked them about their reflections on ageing, what they've enjoyed most about getting older and what's important to them now.
Hello, I'm Celia and I am 71 very soon.
I'm Sue and I'm in my 86th year and very content to be there.
I'm Lindy and I'm just in my 8th decade.
I wanted to ask because sometimes it's considered a little bit taboo or a bit rude to ask someone's age. Do you mind saying how old you are?
No, never. I never mind aging or being my age.
No, not in the least. All I am is surprised that I've got to my 86th year.
And I'm completely different. I don't like saying what my age is because I don't feel my age.
I was going to ask, how old do you feel? Do you feel...
25. With a more sensible head.
How do you feel about the word old?
I most often feel that it doesn't really mean me. Unlike Lindy, most often I feel as though mentally I'm 12. So for me, the age isn't the thing. It isn't old. It is, okay, I am now almost 71, and that's fine. And I just try to keep going as much as I can and enjoy myself as much as I can.
You know, there's that saying, act your age, not your shoe size. Do you think that you act your age?
I think that probably I do a lot of the time. I have always been fairly mature. So, you know, when I was 12, I was probably that, as I am now, picky, grammatically correct whenever I could be, person. So in a lot of ways, it's a continuum. It is not that, you know, oh, suddenly I am old. I noticed age when I got my first gray eyebrow lash, and that was it. You know, age 41, I suddenly had a gray hair, and that was it. But I never thought of it as, oh, I'm old.
I'm going to be looking out for a grey eyelash, a grey eyebrow hair now. I'm going to go back and look in the mirror. Have there been any positives or things you've really loved about getting older?
In my case, retirement, to be perfectly honest with you. I've had for decades problems with musculoskeletal issues, et cetera, et cetera. I started the disability service at King's College London. So for 26 years, basically, I've worried about other people all of the time. So the amount of stress, et cetera, you know, if you're a certain sort of person, that's what happens to you. So you might wear yourself out. Whereas retirement, I volunteer all of the time, I'm very busy, but I'm choosing what I do, when I do it, how short or long those bits are, etc. And it's great fun. So I'm very active, I'm really enjoying it, and I have a lot less stress than I did when I was younger and when I worried more about other people than myself.
Well, Lindy Sue, are there any stereotypes that frustrate you, people have about what an old person should be like, what they think older age is like?
Oh, that you should behave yourself.
Do you behave yourself?
Not all the time, no.
So, eighth decade, what did you think being this age would be like when you were younger? Did you have ideas about what it would be like?
Yes, I did, because I was very, very close to my great-grandmother, who was Victorian, believe it or not. She was born in 1876. She was the closest thing in my family. I mean, I loved her, I can honestly say, more than my parents. She was a real example of somebody who I would like to be. And I think that was mostly because she had a great sense of humour. And we used to do silly things, like she had a big collection of hats. And when I went to her house, which was every Friday on my way home from school, she would give me an orange and then we'd get the hats out and put the hats on. And then we'd sort of take on a persona relevant to the hat and have silly conversations about, you know, oh, I've put my washing out today and it's been freezing cold, as it's as stiff as a board, and things like that. And I always wanted to be her, really. And I think I have turned into her in some ways. She was such a great role model.
Do you feel like she was a role model for ageing, and that you channeled it a bit?
Yeah, because she was a bit crazy at times, you know, even when she was old, that word we don't like to use. She was. She'd put some music on. We'd dance around the room and things. And this was when she was, yes, in her 70s, 80s, 90s. Yeah. I certainly don't feel my real numerical age. It largely, I think, depends around your health. If you've got failing health and you've got issues that debilitate you, that limits what you can actually physically do, and it limits whether you can go out a lot. And I think that staying young is all about being with other people, feeding energy, passing stuff about, which is why we do a lot of volunteering. That keeps us young. I think it's keeping active as well.
Picking up from what Lindy was saying, we're incredibly fortunate in this area particularly, because there's a lot for older people, and it's giving as well as taking. I don't like those organisations that people say, oh, well, you can come to the Memory Cafe and you can play Scrabble or you can play Ludo or Snakes and Ladders. I'd much rather come to HUK, come to things like OPAG, the Older People's Advisory Group, and it's a forum in which we can talk about issues that matter to older people, but also matter to other people. And the social aspect, the getting together with people who you may have shared work experiences with, or you may have interests in common, maybe interests you couldn't foster when you were working because you were too darn busy. And if you have family, which I have, too many commitments.
If you could give some advice to your younger self, looking back, what would you say now?
I think I stood by my own, it's not exactly beliefs, but my own sense of direction of where I was going to go. I did a lot of very unconventional things. I had a very happy marriage. I had a large family. And I wouldn't change it, not for anything in the world.
I think I would say take more risks. That's something I've learned through my life, is you don't get anywhere if you're sort of worrying about things and, oh, what will happen if? You don't know what's going to happen, so go and find out.
Well, to be honest, I took a lot of those risks. You know, I'm originally from Panama. We moved to the US, but I've lived here over 43 years now. So I've taken a lot of those risks, and it's worth doing what you can when you want to.
I'm at the stage of revolting. I'm not going to do the housework today because I'm going to go out and do something else. I'll go dancing, or I'll go to an art exhibition, or I'll go meet some people for lunch. It's wonderful because it gives you that great freedom to go out and enjoy life. You know, get out there, do it whilst you've still got time. You know, I hope I've got another 25 or 30 years, but you know, it might end tomorrow. And I want to go to the pearly gates knowing that I've had a go at all sorts of things in life. And this association with Camden Age UK is giving us the opportunities to do this sort of thing. So we can play again, you know. We can play. It's great.
How lovely to keep playing. We heard from Lindy, Sue and Celia there. They were talking to our reporter, Martha Owen. You might just be tuning in and are wondering, what are we discussing here on Woman's Hour? I'm Anita Rani and I've got a brilliant panel of guests in front of me. Pippa Stacey, Dr. Sharon Blackie, Callie Beaton and Dr. Radha Modgill. And we're all talking about women and ageing and how to do it well. Here are some more of your messages. Binny says, I love the ageing process. I'm just shy of 69. Started running, you'll like this, Radha, at 63.
Amazing.
Not getting faster or better, but I just feel better. I wear my pigtail and space buns and Miss Havisham hair with pride and indifference all at the same time. Cheers to all of you, women of all ages. And Rachel says, and this is a real reality check, she says, my best friend died this week after a long and difficult battle with lung cancer. She held my hand recently when I was moaning about my fine lines and wrinkles, and she looked me square in the eyes and said, aging is a gift. I will never take it for granted. Thank you for those messages. Now, on to my next guest. Comedian and podcaster Callie Beaton had a high-flying career as a TV executive working with brands like Nickelodeon and MTV. But at 45, she swapped the boardroom for the comedy club after receiving career advice from one very famous female comedian. Who was she and what was the advice?
Well, I used to work with some big sort of on-screen talent names, not because I had a sort of sexy showbiz career, but I was on the revenue-generating side. I sat on the board of some big companies. And one of the people I had the enormous pleasure of working with on a few occasions was the late, great Joan Rivers. And we got to know each other very well. I didn't realise until I started sort of hanging out with her what a feminist icon she actually was. You know, when she was doing what she was doing, busting through the glass ceilings of Hollywood in the 60s and 70s, and she said a couple of things to me. The very last time I saw her, we had dinner together, just the two of us, not long before she died.
Lucky you.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was, yeah. And you may remember she died very unexpectedly from complications in surgery. And she said two things to me. One of them was I was online dating at the time, and so was her daughter, Melissa. And she said, Callie, the thing about online dating is, she said, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. I thought I'd share that. And the other thing she said was, she said, you should think about taking up stand-up. I think you could do it. And I said, you know, at the time, and I said, I'm 45, I'm a single parent. I've got two kids. One of them's got special needs, and I've got a boardroom job. It's too late. The ship has sailed. And she just looked me in the eye and she said, I'm 81. What's stopping you? You're in the thick of it. And the combination of that and her untimely death a couple of weeks later, I've thought back on it and I've thought it's a much better story because it was Joan Rivers, lovely dinner party story. But if any 81-year-old woman had got to know me and had seen something in me and had looked me in the eye and told me I was young, which it was young, she said, you're in the thick of it. And at 55, I look back at my 45-year-old self. I mean, I did lots of things that year. I ran my first marathon that year. I did lots of things that year. And people now say to me, isn't it amazing? You did this amazing kind of pivot in your career and it's so great. But this won't be my last reinvention. So why would it have been my last one? So that also is quite limiting for people to say, good for you. You did that at 45. Well, at the moment, I'm learning classical piano again and playing in recitals. That'll be part of my next reinvention. I'm writing my first book. All of us can have ambition in our reinvention as we age. But that does not mean it's redemptive or perfect. So I'm not saying to you, isn't it amazing? I did this life pivot and look at me now. You know, my life's a hot mess. I'm fitting the wheels as I fly the plane, for sure. But it's my hot mess and I'm telling my story my way. And if I fall down, which I do a lot, I'll stand up again, literally quite often on stage.
Yes, sister. I took so much from what you just said. But one thing that at the very beginning is that just the joy and the wisdom that can come from spending time with women from different ages, particularly older women.
One of the joys, I think, of what I do now is how big your world gets. So I think one of the things that can be aging, and this has nothing to do with looks and it has nothing to do with
what
society...
Which we will get to.
Yes, it has nothing to do with what society tells us. But when your world gets smaller and smaller and your world becomes, you know, your sofa or you sort of self-limit, then I think, and some people obviously it has to become that way, but for some of us it doesn't. And if your world keeps getting bigger, I'm lucky enough that every working day is different and I meet hundreds and hundreds of people every month probably, and they're not like me. Very rarely am I with a woman who is like me in a working environment. It's usually somebody who's very different to me. And that is so powerful, I think. Because we don't know what we don't know. And if we sort of socialise in our own image, the whole will never be greater than the sum of the parts. So all, you know, we can underestimate and ignore any demographic if we want, but why would we? Why would we? And we used to do reverse mentoring when I was at MTV, where we would have people who were closer to the age of the demographic who watched, having meaningful casting votes on editorial decisions because they were watching that kind of stuff and people my age weren't.
Going, wicked means good, right?
exactly. Yeah. But we knew it was working when we stopped calling it reverse mentoring. We just took the word reverse out. Because why would somebody of another age not mentor you? So I think it's about taking wisdom from whatever source it may come, which often isn't the one you might be expecting it to come from.
Pippa, do you have older women in your life? Does your generation look to older women for advice? You are the voice of your generation here on Woman's Hour now.
Oh gosh, the pressure. I think my generation, the paths tend to cross less with people from older generations. And I definitely would like more of that in my life, because even just from sitting here today, I've learned so much. And I think there's so much we can gain from hearing those experiences. But where do you go to find that if you're not crossing it in your daily life? How do we create that sense of community and give people the opportunity to share those experiences together? My situation probably isn't that unique in that I've lost all my grandparents and I've lost a parent. So when that happens, where do people in that situation go to find that source of advice and that comfort as well? I think that's a really big point.
I think so as well. And if it doesn't exist in the workplace either. I want to talk to you, Kelly, about when you were a boardroom exec. In my mind, all of a sudden, you've got shoulder pads on. But that
point, have them sometimes a long time ago.
How was it? How did women treat each other then? And was there a pressure to remain a certain way and to stay young and to deny your age and all the rest of it? What was going on?
A couple of things struck me in those days. One was that people often wouldn't think I was a board member. So they would sort of ask me where the loos were, or could they have the biscuits or whatever. So I got a lot of that. The first time I ever went to a board meeting for Carlton Television. They were on the top floor of, I think it was number one Knightsbridge back then. And I was on the executive floor and I needed a wee. And I was told I could either use the disabled loo or go downstairs to the next floor where the secretarial pool were, because there was no ladies' loo on the executive floor. Yeah. And I think the thing that I remember I used to notice a lot, because I've worked mainly for US companies, big US studios, and I noticed a lot the expectation on women to look impeccable. So I'd go to meetings in LA and you'd go to the big networks there and the women would look incredible and have incredible CVs, and the men would not always have to look in any way incredible. I thought that's interesting that there's a double standard here that we've got to maintain. But I would also say that there was, I don't know if this is still the case, but sometimes people taking on behaviours, it's not always the case that women were my biggest allies, and some men have been really good allies to me. So it's really hard to gender that across the piece, because everybody's obviously individual. But I would not say that it was a question of men silencing me and holding me back and women carrying me up on their shoulders at all. And I think when I was first in boardrooms, which was 25 years ago, because we sold a production company to ITV, so I unexpectedly found myself in that environment. In those days, there were so few women, and some of them were not helpful to me, because it was almost like, well, I've got that role, what are you doing here?
Yeah, because there's only one space at the table.
And they're often, and on comedy bills, you know, it's very frequent you're the only female. We always sort of joke, if there are two women my age on the bill, we always joke they've probably made a sort of clerical error. and they sometimes say, oh, what are you, like, ask us what we're going to talk about. Like, it must be the same thing. I think this is the kind of nuanced situation of where we're at in regard to gender, in regard to age. For every story I tell, there'll be somebody listening now going, well, I've had the opposite experience. And even being aware of that, I think, is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to bring in a question for everybody. And this is about gendered ageism. This is an issue at play for many women. One female office manager, Karen Farquharson, in Peterhead in Scotland last September won £37,000 after her boss dismissed her menopause symptoms when she called in sick for work, calling her an old biddy with aches and pains. Sharon, you're all about power of the menopause and how we harness it, but some women have faced discrimination because of it.
I think it's absolutely true, and I think you see that all the way through history. I mean, if you look at Snow White, the story of Snow White, you know, the so-called wicked stepmother who wants to be the most beautiful while her young stepdaughter is growing up to be even more beautiful. And that's because women, even up to today, are living in a culture where our utility is valued by how beautiful we are and how fertile we are. So the stepmother in Snow White is just as much of a, you know, a product of that environment as the woman that you're talking about. And I think it's really incumbent upon us to try to change that narrative. When it's wonderful today that there are more conversations about menopause, but almost all of the conversations that I hear are about clinging on to youth at all costs.
Yes.
And that's what Snow White's stepmother did, and it didn't end well. So I think it's finding ways to move the story on.
How often, Kelly, do you get told that you don't look your age? Because whatever people's perception of 55 is, you're not it.
Exactly. I get told that all the time. And I do look my age.
Yes.
I look like a 55-year-old woman. And what I often think is, when people say that to me, I say to them, well, then you're not meeting many 55-year-old women.
Mm.
Because among my peer group, I do not look exceptionally young, glowing, wonderful. Around this table, I don't stand out as somebody young, glowing and wonderful in how I look. It's people's perception of what that would be. I do, however, know that looks really matter in breaking into, particularly on screen and on stage. I would say 80% of my work involves people seeing me. And as you know, even the work we're doing now, you know, actually it's all about being seen. It's all about social media. There's always a visual element to even audio things nowadays. And it does matter how you look. There's no question that you get booked as well if you look sort of nice in a lineup on something. And you know, unpopular as it may be to say it, the fact of the matter is, if I decided to go really, you know, let my hair go, so, well, my hair's sort of brown, not grey, but it's not as red as it looks because I enhance it. You know, that's what I do. Yeah, it's a fact of what I do. Would I care as much about how I look if this isn't what I did for a living? I can't say, because this is what I do. But unfortunately, it has a big impact. And it's partly how you look, and it's partly creating a brand. You know, the reason I have this hair, still this haircut, is because it's really easily identifiable. And it helps people find me on social media and on screen, which isn't vanity. That's for my career. I need people to sell tickets. I need people to read my book. You know, I've got to get the word out.
Yeah. just a reality. We've another message here from one of our listeners. Alice got in touch to say, I'm 35 and I generally feel comfortable with aging and the changes my body will go through. I want to embrace it fully and live life at each stage naturally, but it's difficult when so many of my friends are starting to get Botox to look younger. It makes me feel even older and it's tough keeping up the resistance not to use it too. I'm not against cosmetic treatments, but I just wish everyone could feel comfortable in their own skin without it, because if you're some of the only people who don't, you feel like you're less beautiful. I'm intrigued that our youngest person here, Pippa, you are nodding as though you can relate to this. You're only 29.
Yep. There are conversations among people my age about what they might like done, what they're planning to get done. And I always just think, I mean, I don't think I would ever do that myself, because I don't think I would want to undergo a medical procedure just for cosmetic purposes, given my own background and my condition and my health. But when people are all going for these same things like lip fillers and Botox, I always just end up thinking, are we all going to have the same face one day? Is everyone going to look exactly the same? And it makes me sad that people are so willing to cast that individuality aside. I definitely understand where the need and the want comes from, given the pressure that we are fed by social media and the world around us to appear young and youthful for as long as possible. But yeah, I don't like it. And even as somebody who has no interest in that, I am feeling the pressure and thinking, am I going to be the only one who doesn't do it? So it's a weird one.
There are lots of people younger than you, though, who have done it, aren't there? I know a couple of my daughter's 24, and a couple of her friends, well, more than a couple of her friends from school, have had lots of work done.
I want to introduce Pippa. We've heard her voice, Pippa Stacey. She's a writer and content creator, and her book, How to Do Life with a Chronic Illness, was just released a few weeks ago. Congratulations, you.
Thank you.
Pippa was diagnosed with ME, also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, while she was at university, and lots of her writing focuses on how to help others facing the same thing. So, Pippa, you've had to think about things that a lot of 29-year-olds don't. What's that been like?
Yeah, it's a strange one. I think nobody expects to go through something like that at such a young age. So I was around 14, 15 when the symptoms started. I didn't get my diagnosis until 4 years later, because I would constantly go to the GP and they'd see me as just this young teenager and they'd say, oh, it's just hormones, it's all in your head, it's not that serious. And I think having that experience really carries through as well. But as much as I would have loved for this not to happen to me, it's not ideal and it makes life very tricky. I think having to contend with losing your mobility at a young age means I'm less afraid of that happening in later life now, because I know that it's possible to have that loss of mobility and to have a body that can't keep up with your mind and what you want out of life, and to start using mobility aids in a wheelchair. And I've learned that it's not a bad thing. In my case, using a wheelchair has been one of the most compassionate decisions I've ever made for myself, because it means I can do more of the things I want to do at less cost to my body. So from a physical perspective, I think a lot of people in my generation have that fear about how aging is going to impact them physically. But having to deal with that at such a young age, I know that as humans, we are so much more adaptable than we think we are.
So what advice then would you give people who are decades older than you, but who might be dealing with physical health issues for the very first time?
I think you don't have to play down how you're feeling, because it is a big adjustment and the world we live in isn't accessible and there are going to be difficult things you face. But it's always worth looking into the mobility aids and the support that exists to help you. There is a lot of it out there. Well, there's some of it out there. And it's just a case of looking for it. And a lot of people I speak with now, my generation and older actually, have this fear about using a wheelchair and like the stigma that comes with that. And yes, there is stigma around that, especially in somebody in my situation who uses a wheelchair part time. But ultimately, I think you have to think about, will doing this allow me to live a life that feels more like mine again? And if doing that is a compassionate decision, and if it is going to benefit you, not just from a physical health perspective, but also from a mental health perspective, that is absolutely a good enough reason to consider it. And you don't need anybody's permission to do that.
I wonder how your friendships and relationships with your peers changed when this happened to you, and their thoughts on aging and yours. And can they relate?
They can't relate.
No.
A lot of people can't relate, and it took them by surprise just as much as it took me. So they've definitely learned a lot, and they've learned it alongside me, which is brilliant. And there are often cases now where they're going about their life and they'll text me and they'll say, I saw this access barrier today and I would never have noticed that if it wasn't for the experiences I've had with you. But I think for anybody going through something like what I went through, it's absolutely vital that you have people that you can relate to. So finding the chronic illness community on social media I don't know what I would have done without it. And I think no matter what age you are, you have to have people who have some idea of what you're going through as well, and just people that help to normalise that experience as well.
Community, Sharon, finding a community.
Yeah, and finding a community of others, I think, who are not so much in denial, because, I mean, I don't want to sound uncompassionate, but I think one of the problems that we face with this constant clinging on to youth is we're not really experiencing this part of our life to the full. In at the beginning of the pandemic, I was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of lymphoma and almost died, but didn't, happily, and am in remission. But that experience for me was very much about looking at my body and really appreciating everything that, you know, my cronky wrists had done for me and my cronky knees and all of the times that that had served me. And I think if we don't look at our bodies and find a way to be in our bodies at each of these ages, and we're constantly either living in the past or worrying about the future, then that's not really healthy for our mental health, let alone our physical health.
We are going to hear from some younger people, though, because we got in touch with the BBC Radio 1 Life Hacks team, the presenters Shaniqua and Lauren, and they chucked a couple of questions our way, especially for you. Have a listen. This is Shaniqua.
Hey, Woman's Hour, it's Shaniqua Paris here from Radio 1's Life Hacks. Now, when it comes to getting older, I've noticed that I need, with a capital N, my sleep. And I remember before, I would go away like on holiday and I would be partying all day, partying all night, and then have 2-3 hours sleep, and that's absolutely fine, and I've got all the energy for the next day and the next day and the next day, and then I come home and then I'm straight back to work like nothing even happened. Yet now if I don't get my full 9 hours sleep, then I am struggling and it's hard for me to concentrate, and then I notice like I'll start to get sick or even like I'll get colds and stuff. So my question is, as we get older, do we actually need to get more sleep?
Who's partying?
I party more, and I need less sleep. Definitely, I work nights. I've become nocturnal, and I used to need 8 hours sleep a night, and I do not anymore.
What is there? Is there a pattern? Because I don't think my mum ever sleeps. She's always just awake. Do teenagers need more sleep? Do we need, like, what happens, rather? What happens to our bodies?
Yeah, so, well, first of all, we don't pay enough attention to sleep, and it's super important, just as much as exercise and what we eat. But yeah, there are changes as we kind of go through our lives. I mean, I think teenagers get a really bad deal because everyone's always moaning about teenagers. Oh, they can't get out of bed in the morning. But actually, that's what is supposed to happen to them. So they definitely need much more sleep. And I think actually in kind of older age, sort of very older age, actually we need less sleep. So it's showing that we need less sort of hours of sleep, but also the quality of sleep is not necessarily as good. So in the middle, there's kind of seems to be a bit of a variation. Having said that, you know, sleep is also defined by our individual kind of chronotype, we call it. So, you know, we have our own individual kind of setting in terms of body clock.
How are your sleep patterns?
Not great, not the best, but that comes hand in hand with my condition. But while you were talking, I was thinking about or the teenagers who go off to uni and have that lifestyle. And that was how it was for me pre-disability. Like, you study all day, you're always with your friends. The night out starts at 11 p.m. And even though I'm the youngest one here, I absolutely could not do that now. No way. I've got no interest in doing it. And we are hearing a lot more about the value of sleep now, which I think is really good. I think it's one of those things like the menopause where there does need to be more conversations about it.
Let's hear Lauren's question.
The question that I would love to ask you about aging is about friendships. My friends and I have been friends since school and we continue to have a really strong friendship. Obviously, making friends becomes harder as the years go by. There seems to be less and less opportunity to meet people. And me and my best friends, we always say, oh, yeah, we're definitely going to be friends in our 50s and 60s. So I would love to know about your friendships. Have you got those lifelong friends? Have you made more friends as you've gotten older, and have you found anywhere different to make friends?
Sharon?
I think as you grow older, it can be more difficult to make friends, partly because it's just so hard to reveal yourself and there's so much of life to reveal. So I think you never get, or very rarely, I shouldn't say never, it's very rare to get the depth of friendship, I think, when you're making them late in life compared to young friends when you've grown up together, they already know all about you. But sometimes when you get to like 60, you know, where do you start to explain who you are and how you've got to be that person?
Do you need to though? I find that I've met some of the most amazing friends, honestly, lifelong friends who I've met at this point in my life, and we've just clicked, because who I am now is true to, and who I was 20 years ago kind of doesn't matter. I mean, this is just my experience.
To me, I remember someone saying, one of my oldest friends saying to me that friends are for a reason, for a season, or for life.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely saying. And I've definitely found that as well, that I've had much more meaningful female friendships, certainly since my 30s. That's when I went to a boys' school and was very sort of male orientated for a long time.
Weren't you the only girl?
Yeah, in a boys' school. So in case you're wondering why I'm a comedian.
Explains everything.
Yes, I had to develop a sense of humour. But yes, I think you can make meaningful friends and actually maybe more of a diverse group of friends, I would say. Now, when I look at my friends, I think friendship, female friendship, I think is probably the biggest gift in my life.
Yes. And if you're lucky, intergenerational female friendship from all walks, younger, older. Pippa, as a younger woman, you've heard this conversation. How do you feel about getting old? Are you feeling positive? Have we scared the life out of you?
You've not scared the life out of me. I'm just sat here soaking it all in. And it's just so lovely to have the opportunity to have these kinds of conversations because we just don't access them enough. And it's definitely reassured me. Like, I would like to know what I'm in for. I would always rather have the information than not have it. And it's just so great to hear different life experiences and just to know that. I think the phrase you said was you always have the opportunity to regenerate.
Yeah, reinvent.
Reinvent. And I love that. And that's the thing that I'm really taking away from this.
Well, just to give you a little bit of hope, the gender pay gap does still exist, but it's better for your generation than it is for my generation.
That's
so it's getting better. Not there yet. Final questions to all of us. What can we do to help each other, different generations of women, Sharon?
I think really by providing inspiration. So when I do book events about Haggitude or hopefully my forthcoming book, I find a lot of younger women in the crowds and sometimes teenagers that are there with their parents or whatever. And really it's about providing for them some reason to grow older, you know, some reason to actually stick it out and get to the end and some idea that there is joy in that as well. So for me, it's about convincing younger people that there is something to really, really hope for and to live for as you grow older.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Kelly?
For me, it's about debunking the having it all, having to be it all, having to look, you know, beware of comparing your insides with other people's outsides. I think that's good. That's good advice for all of us.
Radha? I think if, you know, all generations of women can be honest and be authentic, then I think, you know, a lot of sort of suffering, distress and confusion would be saved. So that would be my one thing is honesty.
And Pippa?
I think my generation has a lot of privileges because of the women who fought for them before us. But I also think that there is a lot of pressure on my generation to still hit those societal norms, whereas I really want a society that glorifies the idea of walking your own unique path and empowering the women who choose to do that as well.
Wonderful. Oh, it's been great. It's flown by. Thank you to all my guests, to Kelly Beaton, Dr. Sharon Blackie, Pippa Stacey and Dr. Radha Modgill. And let's continue the conversation because I know those of you listening have got your thoughts and opinions. You can email us via the website or get in touch with us at BBC Women's Hour on social media. Thank you for joining us for this Women's Hour special programme on ageing. We hope we've inspired you to have your own conversation with the women in your lives, old and young. Join Hayley Hassel on Women's Hour tomorrow. Until then, have a lovely bank holiday Monday. That's all for today's Women's Hour. Join us again next time.
I'm Alex Krotowski.
And I'm Kevin Fong.
How do you feel about AI?
Does it scare you?
Very quickly, that question comes up. You know, is it going to think for us?
Does it excite you?
I say, how is the AI going to help us to think better?
Do you worry about how it'll change your life, your job, your kids?
AI is built into many of the software applications that we now use in the schools every day.
In every episode of The Artificial Human from BBC Radio 4, Kevin and I are here to help. We will chart a course through the world of AI and we will answer your questions.
It doesn't just lie, but it lies in an incredibly enthusiastic, convincing way. That ability to be able to kind of think critically is just going to be so important as we move forwards.
The Artificial Human with me, Alex Krotowski.
And me, Kevin Fong.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Wie Führung in Zeiten der Unsicherheiten und der multiplen Krisen geht, darüber sprechen wir in unserem Führungspodcast. Ich bin Kai Dierke.
Und ich bin Anke Huben. Seit 25 Jahren sind wir Vorstandsberater. Wir beantworten die Führungsfragen unserer Zeit, inspirierend und informativ.
Wir räumen mit den Mythen der Führung auf. Und wir geben an aktuellen Beispielen aus Wirtschaft und Politik konkrete Lösungsansätze.
Dierke und Huben, der Führungspodcast. Jetzt reinhören und souverän an der Spitze agieren.